Hi, everybody. Thanks so much for joining this special roundtable discussion with Jacques Sebesajo from Amani Global Works, a wonderful NGO based in Democratic Republic of Congo. It's funny, I just met Jacques at a conference here being held by the Malago Foundation. We were actually paired together to be roommates in the hotel and got to talking about his incredible work out in Congo. And I thought, what better opportunity than to connect and to talk about some of the experiences that you've had in making this incredible organization. So thanks so much for being here with us.
Oh, thank you, Dan. Yeah. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. So let's jump right in. Let's start with a little bit about your history and how you got to the place you are today.
So my name is Jacques Sebesajo. I am from Idjwi, an island, a big island in the middle of a big lake between Rwanda and Congo. And this lake is 1,000 feet deep, 50 miles long. Idjwi Island has 300,000 people, and it's divided in two parts. There is virtually divided in two parts, the north and south. And they have two kings, one in the north and another one in the south. So I am from there, and my father was the first mayor of this Idjwi Island right after the independence in 1960.
He was the mayor.
Yeah.
And so you grew up there, but ultimately you went on to higher education.
Yeah. And then, so I left early on. We went to the mainland, in its cities in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. I went to medical school there. First, I went to seminary because I wanted to become a priest. And then I realized that my calling was more in medical field. And I studied medical school in the DRC and then moved on to Rwanda, where I graduated from medical school. And then
And what year was that?
2002.
And so you graduated medical school with a couple of years of seminary school under your belt.
Yes.
What made you open an NGO instead of a private practice or working with the government, or a million pathways available to you?
So when I wanted to become a priest, my goal was to work in the communities and help people. You know, I always considered priests as the best people in the community, that always available for people. Then I realized doctors really were, like, if you, I had two choices, either open a private practice or build an infrastructure that would welcome people who otherwise could not afford healthcare. I was passionate about that.
Interesting. So ultimately, though, you did some traveling, ended up in the United States. We had that fascinating discussion. Tell us what happened there.
So, we were going to Toronto.
Yeah, and Canada.
Toronto, Canada, and my wife and I, and we didn't have a Canadian, we were denied a Canadian visa. We had a United States visa. And just like that, I told my wife, why don't we go to United States and spend 2 days and then just take a bus to Canada? Like someone can cross from DRC to Rwanda. You go back and forth.
No problem. Just walk across the border.
And then it wasn't the case. So we got stuck in New York, and here we are. We were fortunate to be stuck in New York. And then after that, a few years later, I really felt that urge to go back and continue what we've started. That's how we went back to Idjwi and built this hospital. And I was working there as a physician. We also hired nurses. And the story goes on.
Interesting. So then initially, though, was it always an NGO, or what was the phasing out of the work?
So it wasn't an NGO. So we started as a private, my wife and I funded this from around 2005 to 2011 when we ran out. So it was, we grew up in a society where there were many, many NGOs, big aid NGOs in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. After the Rwandan genocide, helping refugees. And for us, in our views, we hadn't seen many impact. So we didn't want to become like that. We said, and also based on our, how we've been raised, to give up to the community, you have to, whatever you make, you have to split it. And that's how what we did for almost 6 years. And then we ran out. And a friend came and said, I want to give you money, but I want my tax write-off.
A U.S. donor.
Yeah, a U.S. donor. So we had to register as a 501c3, like an NGO, weren't happy about that, but you know, finally it works well for us.
Yeah.
Because it helped us maintain the hospital and even grow more to open more clinics and hire more doctors and nurses.
Fascinating. And you said that the entire island is about 300,000 people.
Correct, yeah.
And I remember you said that life expectancy is pretty low, yeah. About 25.
25, yeah, that's the life expectancy. Yeah. And, you know, even more like a woman has an average of 8 babies.
Wow.
And 90% of people, of those 300,000 people, have a high burden of intestinal worms.
Wow. Despite treatment. So now we're here at this conference in San Francisco, thinking about community health systems and community health integration. Yep. This roundtable discussion is hosted on chwcentral.org, which the audience is largely people who are very interested in community health integration into health systems. So tell us a little bit about your experience with community health workers and community health systems.
So, you know, like having gone through Mulago fellowship experience,
Mulago being a foundation that offered you a fellowship
for 2 years. It's called the Renal Unhold Fellowship Program. It's a rigorous training, and then you put in place a model. So we had a hospital, like it's now a 100-bed hospital. And we also operated in a few clinics here and there. So we realized that we weren't reaching people, the population. People had to walk distances to come to the hospital.
Mm.
But we could have reached people through clinics around. Mm. So we got involved in clinics, and that was not enough. Although we had the clinic, you know, the clinics could refer to the hospital, people in communities were dying. You know, I remember like 3 years ago, more than 50 children died in 1 week.
Wow.
Just with anemia and malaria.
It's terrible.
So we said, okay, why don't we bring healthcare to the doorsteps of the communities? So that's how we got involved with community health workers. We found it. We found community health worker approach as a really innovative program because that brings dignity to the community and gives a chance to the people in the community to serve themselves.
Hmm. So tell me a little bit about what your average community health worker in your system would do. What kind of job? What kind of tasks?
You know, they do almost, they do like a few things, including checking pregnant women and referring them to the clinic or hospital for prenatal checkup,
mm-hmm.
At least 3 prenatal visits during the pregnancy. But they also treat simple malaria,
mm-hmm.
Pneumonia, diarrhea. They treat malnutrition at the community level. But they also follow up on cases that have been discharged from the clinics or the hospital.
Mm. And how many do you have total under your system?
Yeah. Right now, under our system, we have 68 community health workers. Towards the end of this year, 2019, we'll have around 150.
Wow.
And we're planning to expand to around 300 community health workers.
It's a rapid expansion.
Yes.
And are they assigned households or are they assigned number of patients? How's their assignments structured?
So they are assigned households. Each community health workers is assigned 100 households.
I see. And how often do they have to go to the households?
They have to go once a month to each household, but they also have a phone number that the household can call if they they live inside the community in the community. Mm. So if in the middle of the night a child has high fever, you can wake up and go to the community health worker.
Interesting.
But this proactive visit, like regular visit, happens every month, like once a month.
Wonderful.
For housing, yeah.
Now, one of the things that we often go through is these 5 essential questions of building a system in community health.
Right.
Mind you, there's a lot of questions, but some of the big hits are, what do they do? Who are they? How are they trained?
Right.
How do you incentivize them? And then how do you supervise and mentor them long-term for retention?
Yeah.
So they do their work with excellence and fidelity.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit, going down that list of questions, so who are these folks?
So these are people who have been recommended by the village chiefs or the entire community.
Mm-hmm.
And then after we recommend them, we interview them,
mm-hmm.
we test them.
Mm.
And after testing, if you pass that part, we train you for 4 weeks.
I see. So 4 weeks initial training.
Yeah. And then we send you back to the community with a mentor a clinical mentor who follows you in the community and put in, you know, to implement what you've learned in doing the training. And after that, you are confirmed. After confirmation, we give you a backpack with supplies to treat diarrhea, pneumonia, fever, simple malaria, and malnutrition.
Mm.
But we also, on top of that, you have a monthly stipend.
Mm.
Because these are, you know, you cannot beat the system just on volunteers. You need dedicated people. So that's why we pay them.
And how much do you pay them compared to minimum wage?
Yeah, we pay compared to minimum wage, I believe we are like 50% more over minimum wage.
Competitive, yeah. quite a bit. And how much do they work? Is it a full-time job?
It's a full-time job, yeah.
It sounds like a full-time job.
Yeah.
Yeah, they must work hard.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's interesting. So let's pause there for a second and consider that. What are the pros and cons of paying them more than minimum wage?
So these are the pros. They take the job seriously.
Yes.
And they feel valued in the community and by the system.
Hmm.
And it's very important to them. And they feel like they're, you know, being a community health worker is a cool thing in the community.
Mm.
It's not just an old person. These are young people, you know. They're becoming a reference in the community because you have to be recommended by the village chief and validated and approved by the whole community.
Right.
And the fact that you are helping people, you know, we notice that people enjoy helping. And how beautiful it is to be helping.
Mm.
And getting paid for helping your community.
Mm.
So that's the pros. The cons is that sustainable? We don't know.
Mm.
How long can we do this if the government doesn't step in? So that's one thing. The second thing is when you come in the community and you pay more than minimum wage, you have to be careful. Maybe you're destroying the society. Now you're creating competition. Everyone else who comes has to pay that, you know, that wage. Mm. How many organizations can do that?
Mm.
So that's the cons. And so we are working to see what is the best way to do it, to not destroy the social fabric, to not discourage the local initiatives that cannot afford that type of salaries. Mm. So we're working with the community to find the best ways. You
know, the right balance.
Right balance.
And to be the most fair.
Exactly.
You know, it's interesting because we know from countless reports that are available on this website, amongst others, that payment of community health work is actually good for the economy. It employs young people or gives money to older members of a family that might need that money at critical times. But then again, that question of what's the right balance, what is both fair and prudent. I guess that's an ongoing conversation in our work.
You know, Dan, I'll tell you, when we did our survey with Harvard in 2010, we found out that the average annual income of a family was $55.
Wow.
It was so small. So by giving jobs to these community health workers, you know, these are people who've never worked.
Right.
You pay them this amount of money, get them from almost 55 to making $500 a year. That's huge. You know, like that.
$500 a year still sounds like not enough.
Yeah. But from 55.
From 55, that sounds like impressive.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, the economic growth potential, the health, the building of local economies. Right. Well, it's interesting. It seems as if the debate around payment has moved away from just pure, should we pay or not pay? Mm. Most agree if it's work, if it's actual work, you should pay.
Yeah.
Question, how much and the best way to do it?
Right.
Incentives, not incentives.
Right.
That's an ongoing debate. But let's leave that sort of inside baseball aside for a moment. I myself have only been to Congo once.
Right.
It was Goma back in 2005.
Wow.
Because it was my birthday and I was in Gisenyi in Rwanda and I want to see Congo. Why not, right? I've heard so much about it.
Right.
But I do know that that was a time of a lot of
turmoil.
Plus, the volcano had just destroyed a lot of the town.
Yeah. Only 3-4 years after the volcano destroyed the town.
Right? That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, someone said to me, Yeah, we've been having a lot of trouble with our volcano.
Right.
And I didn't know. I said, what was the trouble? And they said, oh, it destroyed the town.
Yeah.
It's like, that sounds like more than a little bit of trouble.
Yeah.
That sounds like a lot of... sounds like maybe, you know, the volcano is the trouble.
Right.
But so... but I did find Congo had a lot of beautiful things. The music was fantastic.
Yeah.
The food. Even in that turmoil, people received us. We were there for a couple of hours,
right.
Barely even. But so tell me a little bit about what it's like to work in the Congo.
I'll tell you one thing, Dan.
Yes.
Most people say, oh, Congo is a challenging place.
Yes.
But it's one of the most exciting place to work.
Really?
Really. I'll tell you why. You know, this is a place that has experienced wars and all the turmoil since the independence, since the 1960s. But these people... and you've just mentioned the volcano that destroyed the whole of the city, but they've been able to rebuild it.
Yeah,
I think what is very interesting in Congo. You know, I've been to a few African countries.
Mm.
The civil society is very, very strong. Where
yeah.
the government is absent, the civil society thrives, and that's what happened in Congo. These people have rebuilt their hospitals, clinics, their roads. Everything you see in DRC has been done by the people with no government aid.
Wow.
So building on that, I think that's what is making us successful also. That's what makes things exciting. You have people to help you build your system.
Hmm.
And especially we who are focusing on this building community approach like to healthcare, that's very important.
Yeah.
That's one thing. So you will have the community support if you work in Congo. But you also will not have a government after you. So you can pretty much implement your things. If they are working, the government will never bother you. That's very important.
Mm.
Yeah. You know, if you are in an extremely well-structured country, it doesn't matter how beautiful your model is. They'll ask you, are you following your guidelines, the government policies and so on? You know, when you have to save lives... sometimes you have to not pay attention to those things.
Right.
As long as you're saving lives, you're giving a chance to poor people, you bring dignity to communities, it's good. And you can make that happen in Congo.
Wow.
Another thing that makes Congo exciting is that if you succeed, it's big. Because of things you mentioned. So it's easy to succeed anywhere.
There's so many opportunities to do what you do and have a dramatic effect.
Right. That's right. So it's easy to succeed anywhere, like a place that is well-structured, organized, everything's clear, you can plan. But if you succeed in Congo, that means you can succeed anywhere on Earth.
Wow.
That's what makes it exciting.
And from... you know, that's also true about New York. And now you've lived in the Congo and now you live in New York.
Yeah.
The two places where you can make it there, you can make it anywhere.
Right. Yeah. You know, New York is crazy.
Yeah.
So when I'm in Congo, it's just, oh my God. It's the craziest place.
Yeah.
So if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere in America. If you can make it in Congo, you can make it anywhere in Africa.
Or beyond,
actually.
Tell us, you know, let's spice this up a little bit. Tell us a story of what it's like, you know, something unusual that happened or something that you think is exemplary of your proudest moment in the work.
This is serious. In 2000, I think, 10. So I used to carry my duffel bags full of medicines from New York. And here I am across Rwanda, and I'm going to Idjwi.
Yeah.
And I think the Marines, the people, the Coast Guard, saw me with my duffel bag. It was greenish, looked like a military bag.
Yeah.
And this is almost during the war. The country was almost divided into the east, was divided from the west, from the western part of the country. And they looked at me, Coast Guard, they said, no, you must be a military crossing.
Hmm.
So they open my duffel bag, they see pills, they see stethoscopes, they ask, who are you? I said, I'm just a poor doctor, I'm coming to just give, you know, like help our poor brothers and sisters. So these soldiers, these Coast Guard, they got angry. They took all the medicines. They thought, this is in Congo. So that's the, you know, it's a danger and the beauty of working in Congo.
Wow.
And then they started arguing. They said, no, this duffel bag looks like a soldier. You must be a soldier. And I said, yes, I am. I'm a soldier for poor. Like, I'm a, like, not a soldier per se, but I was...
I'm a fighter.
I'm a fighter. I fight for the poor.
I fight for the poor.
Yeah, I fight for those who have been excluded from the community. Bring them healthcare.
Yes.
I want them to live beyond 25 years of age.
Yes.
So there was one of these soldiers who really insisted that they let me go.
Wow.
And they came back. The next day, they came back to the hospital.
Yeah.
And each one of them came with $10.
Wow.
Saying they wanted to contribute to that. So I think that was one of the, you know, to being stopped by the Coast Guard, thinking that I was carrying some military thing, to appreciating what I was doing, and to come back the next day with $10. These are people who are not paid.
Wow.
So in DRC, most, you know, at that time, soldiers were not paid.
Wow.
But to, you know, there were four of them. I got $40 from them.
Wow.
That was powerful.
And that goes a long way.
Yeah.
That goes a very long way. That's very powerful. It reminds me, in my early days in Chiapas, Mexico,
right.
I also got stopped by a military. They were looking for drugs,
right?
Because there was a lot of traffic from Central America through southern Mexico. And I had the back of the pickup truck full of boxes.
Yeah.
They opened them all up. They're seeing all these pills.
Yeah.
And they're asking me, what is this? I said, listen, I'm working with this church and this clinic, and I'm a physician, and working with community health workers. And they look at me and they're scratching their heads and they go, you know what?
Yeah.
I have this itch right here, and I see this rash, and I'm not entirely sure. Can you just take a look at it?
Right.
And I'm like, all right, line up.
Yeah.
As long as you let me go, I'll give you guys all a free consult quick.
Oh, that's cool.
You know, it's the universal language, right?
Yeah, true.
Human compassion.
Yeah, human compassion, yeah.
And you know, to reflect back on that a little bit, you went to seminary school.
Right.
And you transitioned to medicine.
Right.
But you also consider yourself a fighter.
Yeah.
And that combination of spiritual, medical, and justice-focused, it's something that you see in a lot of people that work in community health, that work in global health.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about how that all sits within you, and maybe some experiences you've had around that.
You know, I consider myself as a blessed. I survived the worst massacres.
Wow.
So I feel I'm living my second life. So I've been given a second life.
Wow.
And I'm always, you know, like, I have religious background, and I really believe this is me. I always feel like we are responsible for our brothers and sisters, and we have to make sure that they are all okay.
Yeah.
And especially those who have been forgotten. And there are so many places. So yeah, that's what I feel. I, you know, like, when I went to seminary, I really, you know, I admire what religious people, priests and pastors, what they do. But I wanted something practical, work, and, you know, like, put my hands on.
Hmm.
And then the closest thing I got to was becoming a doctor.
Hmm.
And or if I could, or a nurse. But the closest thing was to me becoming a doctor. And I see that when you are in front of a person that is suffering, it's not just the person suffering physically, but you have the whole family suffering.
Mm.
And especially when they're poor, they suffer physically, morally, and they just don't have the means to...
Yeah, financially.
Financially. So that makes it even worse.
Yeah.
So I always put myself in the shoes, what will I, you know, how would I feel?
Mm.
And that's, you know, that's my state, and all the state I am in. I also believe in something, you know, and I get this inspiration from people like Paul Farmer, all the Raj, you know, like, and especially Paul Farmer, like, people who have dedicated their lives for poor people, and the people who are going to places that no one else will go to. I think the most beautiful thing is, you know, when you see the hospital in Haiti, you see the hospitals in Rwanda, or wherever PH Partners in Health is operating, it's beautiful.
Mm.
There's one common sign, there's beauty. The design is perfect. The colors, the painting are amazing. Doctors are the best doctors you find in, you know, they can, whether they come from US or they are locally recruited, they are perfect. And these settings are usually in rural areas where poor people live. That's the most beautiful thing I've seen on earth. You know, in my small experience, bringing dignity to those poor people, showing them that you matter, unleash all the potential that can in those people. I've seen what is happening in Butaro. That community was a poor community.
Yeah.
I was
Butaro being the section of Rwanda where they built Partners in Health, built an oncology hospital.
Right.
And also now a medical school, University of Global Health Equity.
Yeah. That has changed that entire community. That was a poor, extremely poor community. But just bringing those things, like dignity, it's not just saying it. It has to really translate in what we do and what people like what they see. That's what, you know, Paul Farmers and Partners in Health have been doing. So we get inspired by that. So I take all that, what I've learned in seminary, what I've learned in medical school, what I've got in New York, and what I'm seeing at in Paul Farmers and Partners in Health, I apply it in DRC. You just mentioned DRC is a very tough place to work. Because of the wars and the neglect, there are so many poor people. So Paul Farmer cannot be everywhere. So that's what he wants. So we can extend him. You know, we can also go like the disciples. We are also going places too. So
Well, but tell us.
Yeah.
Do you sometimes get in trouble?
Yes, a lot. A lot, and they fight a lot. Like whether with a corrupt government, corrupt leaders, or people say, "Why are you doing this for free? Why?" You know, yeah, like, we don't, you know, these people don't deserve this. You know, I'll speak up, I'll get in trouble, I'll be threatened to be sent to jail, and I think it's okay. You know, no one wants to go there, but for right reasons, I will not change. You know, like, it's not that I'm stubborn, but, you know, for people who are suffering, I will go to jail until they get what they deserve. And we usually win and we lose. And there are places I'm not allowed to go to. It's okay. Yeah, like, but if it's needed, we'll go with force.
Wow. Yes, I mean, that's a level of courage that I think sometimes it's forgotten by people who consider global health a largely technical enterprise.
Right.
Do we have all the right numbers and the right guidelines?
Right.
As you mentioned.
Yeah.
But then to actually reach the most vulnerable, perhaps you do need a courage funded by deep love.
Right.
So you also told me that recently there were terrorist attacks in Kenya.
Right.
And you were in the hotel where that happened.
Right. Yeah, I was just living there. Like, I left 1 hour before that happened.
Wow.
So I was lucky. So, you know, it's been my life. It's like being given second life.
Wow.
Do I deserve it? I don't think so. So what do I do with that life that is being given, constantly giving to me? So I have to be careful.
Right.
And it's not that I'm not going to be careless,
right,
going to dangerous places.
Right.
But I'm feeling more and more that maybe that's how what Amani Global Works is going to become. The blessing and the curses of working in DRC, a war-torn country, maybe we are called to expand to war-torn countries. Like, I'm thinking of the Cameroon, like the western part of Cameroon, the English Cameroon. I'm thinking of Central African Republic or Chad. Maybe that's where we are being called to, you know. Like, so, yeah, what do I make of the second life that is being constantly given to me? That's the question I don't know, but I realize I am alive, so I want to make it.
Well, there's no better life to live than to live it as if it's always a gift.
Yeah.
And especially in the pursuit of giving other people a second life.
Right.
Right. And how many people in the world don't have access to a second life? But yet, how much can you use your second life to extend that gift, that miracle, to those who are least likely to get it?
Yeah.
I think that's ultimately one of the core teachings of this global health enterprise,
right.
in addition to Paul Farmer, amongst others. So, any final things before we wrap up? People listening to this and thinking, wow, that's an amazing story, an amazing life. What else do you want them to know?
So this is what I want them to know, that you can get things done in any situation, in any place, in any country on earth, whether they're in peace or in trouble, like the DRC, like Cameroon, like the Central African Republic, like Afghanistan, you can get anything done. So if you want to make things happen, don't wait for peace to come to intervene. Maybe you are the reason for peace to come. Maybe around you we can all contribute to peace, peace building in the world. And how? By doing what we love with passion and putting ourselves in other people's shoes. That's all I can tell. And to look around you, those who are doing, who have sacrificed their lives to make these things happen. It doesn't have to be priests, preachers, or martyrs, or monks, and so on. It's regular people who live a regular life, like Paul Farmer, like you, my friend Dan. It's the regular people living a normal life. Go to medical school, live a regular life, but you decide, okay, this is the path I'm taking. I'm going to do things. It's not a sacrifice. I'm enjoying doing this, really.
It's a lot of fun.
It's fun, really. Like, if you are having fun playing baseball or football, that's perfect. Hey, I'm happy for you. I'm also happy for myself doing this. that's what I can do.
Well, that's fantastic. And on a final note, so let's say peace continues to extend and the government creates guidelines that look a lot like the systems that you guys use.
Right.
Would you accept them?
Say it again.
Okay. let's say that peace continues to extend, and the government is able to then establish guidelines,
right.
But they reflect the values that you've infused through your clinical system.
Right.
Would you accept them?
I think so. If they reflect those values, three things need to happen, really. One, really taking care of the poorest, the most marginalized.
Focus on equity.
Yeah, focus on equity. If they reflect that, perfect. Yeah, we'll align with them and we'll do it with them. Yeah. And second, fairness is very important. Pay people well. No, don't overpay them, but give them what they deserve and on time.
Mm-hmm.
That's very important. And the third thing, to make it as a policy. If they do all those things, we will go for it.
Institutionalized fairness and equity.
Right.
Sounds like a better world, my friend.
Man.
Thank you.
That's what we're fighting for.
Thank you.
But thank you for having me, Dan. It's a pleasure.
Yes. Well, that's it. Thanks so much, everybody, for listening in. And you can find out more on your website.
www.amaniglobalworks.org.
Fantastic. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.